Hello and welcome to Inside Education on 103.2 Dublin City FM, the programme that brings you insights into teaching, learning and all aspects of education from an Irish perspective. My name is Sean Delaney and you can listen to or download podcasts of previous editions of Inside Education by going to seandelaney.com/podcasts. Dr. Pip Bruce Ferguson is originally from New Zealand, where she worked as a primary school teacher and in third level education. She is currently a member of the Teaching Enhancement Unit in Dublin City University, where her specific role is in the area of teaching and learning development. One of her recent articles is Who Am I Who Teaches, in which she writes about the importance for all educators of ongoing self-exploration and clarity about our values. She writes how she strives to make her biases clear both to herself and her students. Her current work involves providing staff development for faculty in Dublin City University. When I met up with Pip, I wanted to find out more about the educational journey she had travelled since she began teaching. I asked her why she had originally become a primary school teacher.
I had a year in the States as an exchange student, and when I came back, it was in the middle of the academic year in New Zealand, and all my colleagues had gone on to whatever career they were going into. And I really had no idea what to go into. And my father, who knew my tendencies quite well, said, why don't you try primary teaching, you know, because I think you would be good at it. So I waited until the beginning of the next academic year and got accepted in a teacher's college. I'm the second in a family of eight, so I've had a lot to do with small children.
And what was your teaching experience like at primary school?
I enjoyed teaching primary school, but At the last year that I was teaching, I had 38 children, and it would be the equivalent of a fourth year of primary school class, and that was quite hard to manage.
That'd be 8-year-olds, is that
yeah,
right?
Yeah, 8 or 9-year-olds. We called it standard two, you know, that kind of level. The other thing that I found a bit problematic is that I'm a bit inclined to possibly overbond with my students, and some of my students weren't in very good spaces, you know, in terms of family situation. And I couldn't do anything about that. And I used to have nightmares about it for months after I'd finished teaching them. So I finally decided I needed to take a break and had my own children. And when I went back into education, I went back into tertiary, where I felt that at least they had some control over their situations.
So did you find it hard to have a boundary then between your work life and your personal life when you were primary teaching?
That's an interesting way of putting it, Sean. I wouldn't have put it quite like that, but it's more a sense of over-engagement, I suppose. I'm a compulsive collaborator, and I've done a lot of that here in Ireland, and I have done throughout my life. And I think that my tendency to want to collaborate meant that I probably didn't set as tight a boundaries between myself and the children. Well, I don't know. You could argue about that, because I think if your heart isn't in what you're doing, you might as well give it away.
And how did it manifest itself?
Nightmares, really. Worrying and getting anxious about some of the kids that I was teaching.
And that didn't prompt you to get involved politically or to try and to do something about it?
At that stage, no. I don't think I had the sense of agency that I developed subsequently. It pained me. I hadn't been brought up in that kind of an environment. I'd been brought up in an environment that valued education and that valued children. And I just found myself gobsmacked at some of the things that my primary school kids, you know, were exposed to and putting up with. And I didn't know how to manage it. So it was, you know, he who fights and runs away lives to fight another day, really.
Yeah, because it is a contemporary issue that comes up in teacher education, that very often teachers are coming from backgrounds that are quite different to the backgrounds of the children they're teaching, and people worry about how well equipped teachers are, given the backgrounds they come from, to cater for the diverse children in their classes now.
Yes, and that can go both ways, really, because my PA year, my first year out of Teachers College, I was in a very high socioeconomic area, and the children were kind of kiss my foot teacher sort of, and I found that quite hard to deal with because I wasn't used to that level of privilege and expectation. But I didn't worry about those kids because they were already privileged. It was the ones that were at the bottom of the socioeconomic heap that I worried about.
You've been described as an avid self-developer. What does that mean?
Who described me as that?
On your website, or on one of the webpages I found about you.
All right, it must have been me then, back in the day. I guess it's an issue of not ever being totally satisfied with where I've got to. The recognition that I'm standing on the shoulders of giants, and one of these days I'd like somebody to stand on mine as well. That sounds quite egotistical, but I think I've had a lot of help from some very, very skilled and experienced people. And now I'm at this stage of my academic life, I like to sort of try and help those people, you know, other people in my turn.
So were you following a particular path of self-development throughout your career?
No, it was much more ad hoc than that, Sean. That sounds quite deliberate. I'm doing a paper for the Collaborative Action Research Network conference in Lincoln, and the paper involves tracing my educational history, my teaching philosophy, and how action research has influenced that. And part of that has made me actually go back and look at the influences that have helped me to develop both my teaching philosophy and my ways of being as an educator. And I guess it has been quite ad hoc. It's been being exposed, for example, to a course when I joined the Polytech system as a staff developer, a course called Culture, Identity and Learning, which actually got you looking at what your own cultural identity is and how that might impact on your interactions with other people, particularly in the New Zealand context with Māori. And it started to open my eyes to the fairly monocultural way I had been practicing up till then. I didn't really get that sense of agency at that point. It was more like the scales falling off my eyes to some extent.
So what guided your choices then in regard to self-development? Was it looking out for courses? Was it opportunities that came your way? What guided you in whatever way it happened?
Well, values are always at the forefront of what we do, I think, whether we acknowledge them or not. I was brought up in a family where social justice and equity really mattered, and my parents were both farmers. And I wouldn't say they were politically active, but they certainly imbued us with those kinds of values. And so one of the drivers, if you like, was the recognition that I do come from a situation of privilege, and there are a lot of people in the world who are not privileged. And the recognition of whether I could actually do something about that evolved over time. When I was primary teaching, as I said, it was more the, oh God, this is dreadful. I've got to get out of this because I can't cope. Rather than what can I actually do to change this, that came later on.
So what would you say then in your self-development were the pivotal moments? Or what were the self-development opportunities that were pivotal in terms of, now I get it, or that means something?
The first one would be that cultural identity course. The second one, I did a Bachelor of Arts in Education while I was doing my teacher's training, you know, and a year subsequently. That had some moments, but probably the most pivotal course would be one I did in my masterate called The Pedagogy of Paulo Freire. And Freire's work as a Catholic social worker in Brazil and developing his liberatory pedagogy was an eye-opener to me, and it was taught by a guy who taught it in Freirean ways. So we would have a two-hour lecture once a week, and the first hour would be Freirean dialogue about what we were doing and why we were doing it, before we actually got any different input. That made me recognise that as a professed Christian, there were things that I could be doing, and not on the level, of course, of what Freire did, but certainly that Christians have an obligation, really, to try and work for social justice and equity, and that's certainly what Freire did. And he got exiled from his native Brazil for pretty much all his life for doing that. For the benefit of listeners who don't know his work, he developed a way of helping the peasants to read and write in about 30 hours in a way that helped them to pass the literacy tests and get the vote in Brazil. And that upset the status quo big time, which is why Freire got the boot from Brazil, because the dominant junta at the time weren't too impressed with that kind of carry-on. But then his methods were subsequently used around the globe. including in Africa, you know.
And how would you say his methods were used by you?
It was less his methods, I think, Sean, although he believed in working from the reality of the people that he was working with. So when I went to school and we learnt to read, it was run, Janet, run, look at Spot and all that kind of stuff. God knows who Janet and Spot were, but there you are. Freire worked with rice, you know, how we plant rice, what is a bomb, because he was working in a very agricultural type with the peasants and who were exposed to domination and violence. So he used the terms that they used in order to help them make sense of education. I suppose if I work from his methods at all, and I would hesitate to claim that, it's more the motivation, I would certainly try and look for ways of drawing the knowledge from the people themselves that I'm working with, rather than what Freire calls liberatory education rather than banking education. He says in banking education, the teacher makes deposits of knowledge in the students, who then kind of build it up and become a second teacher, if you like. So that's all a very one-way, top-down approach, whereas Freire believed in working from the realities of the people and helping them to develop their insights in that way. But it's the motivation more, Sean, I think, that sense that, okay, there is a problem there that needs addressing and what can I do to help it? So I actually then subsequently ended up writing a thesis with the unlikely title of Liberation Theology and Its Relevance to the Kiwi Christian, the case study for which was how Māori have been disadvantaged in the educational system in New Zealand. So the tie-up between those two gobsmacks most people, but it was a Freirean thing. If I'm trying to practice as a liberatory theologian, what is my context? Education. Who is the most disadvantaged group in education? Māori, for a whole variety of systemic reasons. What can I do about this?
And you've been in Ireland now for close to 3 years. How would you see that liberation theology might have applications in the Irish education system?
Oh, I don't think that's for me as a blow-in to actually speculate on. I haven't been here for long enough to know the nuances, and, you know, I think that would be a better guess for an Irish person to say. I would be on very shaky ground coming in from outside.
Okay, but even for an Irish person who knows the system, you know, more deeply, say, what kind of questions should they be asking if they were trying to apply that approach analysing education in Ireland?
Yeah, certainly it would be a case of saying who is advantaged in the education system and why, and what is maintaining that privilege? Who is disadvantaged and why, and is there anything that I can do about that? So we were talking before about whether I would stay on when my current contract finishes. For me, with a commitment to social justice and equity, that is not an option, because I am clogging up a space that is desperately needed by some of my Irish colleagues who are on short-term contracts. And the short-term contract system here is iniquitous. And I've even given out to the president over that, when he did ask. But it is just terrible, because as a staff developer, and I've been working in staff development now for 35 years, we work in identifying the strengths of the people that work around us and connecting people up and pointing this one in the direction of that one and pulling the good teachers in on our workshops and so forth. Well, I'm sorry, but they're here today and gone tomorrow. And that kind of network building is just not happening. If Irish educators could do anything to challenge that, then if I was staying on an island and becoming Irish, that's where I'd be having a go. But I mean, one of the things that I've had to learn since I've been in Ireland is not to refer to myself as a strong unionist. I've always been a strong trade unionist, and one of my colleagues said, you know, you need to get the terminology right here. You'll give people the wrong idea altogether. So, I mean, I would be working through my union to try and challenge that short-term contract mentality. Although, having said that, I do recognise that it comes from government mandate, and possibly before that, from the European Union, I'm not sure. But it is very, very counter-educational.
And you've been involved, as you say, with staff development for 35 years. So how did you get involved in that area? It's always been at third level, is that right?
Yes.
So how did you get involved in that area?
After I'd had my youngest daughter, I got a short-term contract job as a learning assistant in a polytechnic in New Zealand. But the person who was my boss urgently needed a staff developer and saw in me the raw material, I suppose, to do that job effectively. So in double quick time, I morphed from being a learning assistance tutor to a staff developer, and it was my niche. And this guy had worked in the primary system, and basically, I don't know what it's like here in Ireland, but certainly in New Zealand, the primary teacher training is very robust and generalised, and you can pretty much move from there to any place in the educational sector. So the same skills that I used as a primary school teacher, I was able to use in working in tertiary.
So how do you work as a staff developer? And, you know, at what scale do you work when you join a university or you come in new to a university?
Well, the kiss of death is coming in thinking that you know it all and you've got the answers for people. That is the kiss of death. One of the talents I think a staff developer must have is to be a good listener and to identify good practice and to promote that good practice. One of the things that I love doing, and I've done a lot of it over the years, is classroom observations. And I absolutely resile from any sense of those being an inspection or a judgment. It's my opportunity to share a classroom space with an experienced practitioner, take notes on what I'm seeing, and meet with the person afterwards and say, what did you hope to achieve in that lesson? Did you think you achieved it? What do you think your strengths are? Have you got any ideas about how you might do things differently if it needs doing differently? And we have that conversation first before I give them my 7 pages of notes, because I'm a very good typist. And most of the notes are just fly on the wall stuff. You know, this is what I'm seeing you doing. These are the kinds of questions I'm hearing you ask. This is great, the way you interact with this one and that one. And have you thought about using such and such a tool rather than so and so? So it's quite tentative and non-judgmental. And most people find it really interesting, because most people don't get to see themselves teaching. And I remember one of my staff back in New Zealand saying, I didn't realise the level of expertise I had developed until I read your notes. And so it's that sense of learning to value somebody else's practice and to share it around. That's where the action research comes in. Action research being a process that looks at what we're doing and how we can improve it.
Okay, and I want to come back to the action research later, because I know that's an area you have a lot of expertise in. But if we go back to, you know, you're observing in a classroom and you've, you know, and I know you're saying it's tentative and it's non-judgmental, but still you must occasionally encounter resistance from people who just, you know, fear something maybe that isn't that familiar, having a peer observing them.
I generally don't, Sean, because I have never gone in at the invitation of anybody other than the staff member themselves. At one stage in the Polytechnic, we had a head of department who was concerned about a particular staff member and said, will you go in and observe that person? And I said, not unless they invite me in, because that is not the way we work as staff developers. We are not there to pass summative judgments from an HR perspective on a staff member. While we are keenly involved in promoting sound pedagogy and good student outcomes, the motivation has to come from the staff member. So I don't think going in there at somebody else's behest is the way to go at all. I think you need to be there at the invitation of the staff member. The parameters about who gets to see your report need to be very clear, and the staff member needs to absolutely feel safe.
But isn't the consequence of that that possibly the people who most need the support of staff development may not actually take it up, because they may know that there's something wrong and they may just never extend that invitation to you?
You know the old proverb, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make it drink. If people are resistant to having their practice investigated, they will not welcome you. They will teach in ways that are uncomfortable for them and uncomfortable for you to observe, and the whole process will be counterproductive. I do believe that it has to be absolutely a symbiotic relationship. And I have learnt heaps from watching other people teach, and I swipe their good ideas mercilessly and I tell them I'm doing it. But we're investigating a module at the moment with RCSI and Maynooth, trying to get a peer observation for a teaching enhancement system going, where colleagues from one institution will go and observe colleagues at another institution, cross-disciplinarily, you know, if need be. So we might have a business person here observing a nurse teaching large groups in Maynooth, for example. That this is still in the early stages, but this is what we want to happen. Because we can learn so much from watching somebody else teach. And it's shining the light not only on their practice, but on ours. In 1994, this is a little sidetrack, I had a three-month teacher exchange under the British Council Fellowship to Norwich City College of Further and Higher Education. In that, through a professor who was working with us, I was introduced to the notion of videotaping your own practice, which wasn't in 1994 common practice in New Zealand at all. So I got all fired up about this and went back to New Zealand and put the word around my politician and said, this is a good idea, who'd like to have a go at this with me? And I got two takers. One was an agriculture lecturer who subsequently fell out for reasons I won't go into, and the other one was an office technology lecturer. So she videotaped her practice and I videotaped mine. We wrote a review of our own practice and then we swapped the tapes and the reports and looked at each other's practice and what we each thought of our practice. Well, I was kind of had this mistaken idea that I was operating from a Freirean liberatory perspective, but what I actually saw on the videotape was a bossy old bat shifting the conversation right along. And I had written this, you know, the gap between my espoused theory and my theory in use is huge and woe is me. What Kate said, because she'd been a student in my class, she was a fellow staff member, she said, what you are not seeing on the videotape is the student body language. And I have seen you teach and I know how you teach. And you will be moving things along because you'll be picking something up from the group that isn't evident on the videotape. And that's why you think you're bossy. You don't actually come across as bossy at all. I said, bless you, my child, you have done my ego the world of good. But I think we can learn a lot from watching other people teach and from watching ourselves teach.
And if you were to take that, say, the difference between having someone come in from outside and evaluating you, or not evaluating you, but supporting you as an external person, versus trying to make changes yourself and, you know, maybe asking yourself certain questions about your practice, how would you see the differences between those?
There's a quote by Robbie Burns, and I'll try not to do the mock Scottish accent because I'm a terror at doing accent. But it goes, oh, would some power the gifty gee us to see ourselves as others see us. It would fray many a blunder free us and foolish notion. And it's basically saying that we have a perception about the way we do things, but we don't always see reality. Or we don't always see things from diverse perspectives. And having somebody else come in and look at your practice can be enlightening in all kinds of ways. Like the woman I cited earlier who said, I didn't realise how expert I had become until I saw the fine-grained feedback and you were telling me how I did this and how I phrased my question. She said, all that has become completely automatic and I don't know I'm doing it. So I think evaluating our own teaching is absolutely vital and we should be doing it all the time, however we do it. But I think it is healthy from time to time to have a colleague give us feedback. And probably one of the most effective forms of mentoring I have had has been team teaching with other colleagues, because they can, you know, pull you into line if you're getting lost, or, you know, give you ideas about other ways of doing things.
And if you were encouraging somebody to examine their own practice, what kind of questions would you be encouraging them to ask?
What did I do? How did I feel about what I did? Why did I do what I did? Did it have the effects I thought? If it did, why was that and I need to do more of it? If it didn't, what had gone screwy in the process? Those kinds of questions. But I'm a terrible fount of little sayings, Sean, as the Burns quote will tell you. And one of my favourite ones for new teachers particularly is we do the best we know how, and when we know better, we do better. And it's basically saying we need to be gentle on ourselves because we all stuff up from time to time. We stuff up more than usual when we're just starting out because we don't know what's good practice and what isn't. But at the same time, we've generally done the best we knew how to do. And we can learn from our mistakes. Robert J. Kiyosaki, the only bad mistake is the one you learn nothing from.
But even in teaching, you know, you don't even necessarily know that something is a mistake. And maybe what you're actually doing now is better than what you're going to change to do in another few months. Isn't that part of the problem? How do you decide that what you're doing or what you're going to change to is better than what you're already doing?
I think probably the short answer to that is to get feedback, either from your students or from peers, about what you're already doing. If you've got a good reason to implement a change, then introduce the change and then seek feedback again. Don't just rely on your own subjective perspective of things. Because especially if you've invested a lot of time in the change, you kind of have an inherent bias to stay with it.
You have a particular interest in the flipped classroom. Can you say a little bit about what that is?
The flipped classroom is something that's probably been going on for decades or possibly even centuries, but it's now got a nice catchy title. And the idea is that you try to get students doing a degree of engagement outside of class and come into class prepared to share that and to grow from that. So some of the time that would have been spent covering concepts, you encourage the students to do out of class. We've got a guy here in communications, Roddy Flynn, you might want to interview him at some stage, who's done a very extensive undertaking to convert a lot of his practice across to flipped classrooms. He spent a huge amount of time developing little videos that the students could watch out of class and then come in. We had a National Forum funded project called What Works and Why, and he spoke about that in that project, in here, in this room. And it was a warts and all account of what he'd done, and quite impressive because he didn't try to cover over anything. He talked about why he'd done it, how he'd done it, and what he thought about what he'd done. So that sense of trying to move from Freire's, if you like, banking education, the students come into class, you download your knowledge, they go away again, they may or may not. You probably know the old joke about a university lecture is the process by which the professor's notes make it onto the student's page without going through the minds of either. Well, I mean, that's very cynical. But the flipped classroom attempts to change that dynamic and to have the students much more active in the class time.
But it's not just making students more active in the class time, it's also expecting them to do work outside of class. Do students resist it?
Some of them do, and there seems to be some literature, and I can't cite you authors at the moment off the top of my head, that suggest that one of the ways to encourage the students to engage in the out-of-class activities is to make that accessible. So they're getting marks for it. I mean, I have a philosophical problem with only valuing what is assessed, but I recognise pragmatically that that's how most students operate, because of work commitments and time pressures or whatever. Even if they're internally motivated to do the work, the fact that there are marks adhering to it certainly helps.
And Pip Bruce Ferguson's suggestion for incentivising students to engage in flipped classroom activities outside of class brings this week's Inside Education to a close. I'll bring you the second part of my interview with Pip on next week's programme. In the meantime, you can listen to or download podcasts of previous Inside Education programmes from seandelaney.com/podcasts. You can contact me by emailing insideeducation@dublincityfm.ie. Until the same time next week, this is Sean Delaney signing off. Thank you for listening.